This is a conversation I have been looking forward to for quite some while, because I think this is going to be very, very pertinent, very timely, and I'm hoping a quite special conversation with Phil Corbell, who is the Director of Advocacy at Carbon Literacy Project. And we're going to hear a lot more about the project and the work that it does in a short while. But I want to, before we get into that, I want to get to know the man behind the Director of Advocacy title. And the reason I say that is because when you read a little bit about Phil, he has a very interesting past. Self-declared longtime activist for sustainable development, certainly that whetted my appetite, but he's also a longstanding social entrepreneur. He's a broadcaster, community activist, and something that really resonated with me has been known to say that he wishes to leave his children a future, not an apology. And that really resonated with me. So I want to get to know the man behind the title before we get into the work that he and the project does. So Phil, welcome to the podcast today.
Thanks very much, Neil. Thanks for having me. I'm in my, I think my third career. But regardless of career, actually, that thing about leaving children a future, not an apology, is why I'm doing what I'm doing. I'm a dad in Stockport in Greater Manchester, and I'm into my third career because of that, because I became slightly haunted by a future conversation when my girls were really little. I thought to myself, hang on. If things continue the way they're going with the climate crisis, even getting on for two decades ago now, I don't think I'll be able to look them in the eye, actually, and say I did nothing. It was very much that feeling that transmuted what had been a long-standing concern and pick up and put down sort of activity into, no, hang on. This is the time to step up and do your utmost. That recognition of a time of crisis and that everyone has to do their bit. And it was that thinking that led to setting up our social enterprise, Cooler Projects, which in turn instigated the Carbon Literacy Project. So, I mean, if you want the full rewind, I arrived in the amazing city of Manchester in 1981 as a student, and I've never left. I came from the south of England, and I just loved the northern culture. Manchester was a very, very different city then, still in the teeth of the induced economic decline that the current regime had put in place there, unrecognizable from the thriving international city it is now. But I fell in love with the place then and stayed. And got through a circuitous route into radio. I say circuitous. Some of you might know the legendary DJ John Peel. I discovered I could get into gigs for nothing by writing about them. That was my slippery slope into the media, which led to work in radio. And I ended up making documentaries for Radio 4 and other parts of Network BBC, which was an extraordinary, great career for a young person that had low rent. Has to be said. But it was in doing that that I got a commission to make a documentary about a couple riding a tandem back from Sydney, back to the UK in aid of rainforest conservation. And I was sat there receiving audio cassettes from this couple as they rode around the world. And there was a sudden switch of focus from I was the reporter producer into no, actually I wanted to be the participant. This subject so got me, and in 1990 I ended up with my own tandem and my then partner in Sydney, and we set off and rode the blooming thing back to Manchester in aid of rainforest conservation. Life-changing doesn't actually do it justice at all. 14,000 miles, 20 months on the road, away from the beaten track of the usual tourist destinations. I mention it because it took my then perception of environmentalism save the shrimp type, a sort of fetishization of species as a separate thing, into a much more fully rounded appreciation of what sustainable development actually is, and that to try any of this without taking into account the true well-being of people was never going to work. And that, you know, why we have SDGs, etc., that sort of really came home to me in the course of that that ride. And I came back and ended up setting up a charity that established community radio stations on those estates in Manchester where the BBC used to say, literally, do not go to these places unaccompanied. And this was in order to give those populations a voice, absolutely within the remit of sustainable development in the broader sense, give them opportunity, aspiration. And we became a national leading charity called Radio Regen that helped instigate the current growth in community radio stations that we see across the country now. So that was extraordinary and opened my eyes into the world beyond broadcasting, because it wasn't very much about broadcasting. It was everything about social enterprise and how to sustain successful organizations on the ground that happened to be nonprofit. So that was, yeah, that was career two. And then that moment of thinking, now hang on, this climate thing. And couldn't escape that thought, that future conversation that I mentioned. And it was an occasion of a very fortuitous meeting with a like mind, my co-founder, Dave Coleman, who was similarly in that zone of thinking, well, hang on, there's something else to be done here. And we set up Cooler Projects as a social enterprise consultancy, something to fit the gap between the brilliant campaigners of this world and the fully commercial environmental consultancies, something between Greenpeace and Arup, as it were, which is not to be dismissive of either, but something in the middle. And we rapidly got a commission to help the city council create its first climate action plan. And it was in those rooms that carbon literacy came into being.
It's an interesting, hearing that story, and as you say, through the three kind of iterations of yourself, to me, there's a bit of a thread. There's a consistent kind of emphasis, I think, on I don't know, there's a real passion that comes through. It feels that if Phil Corwell does something, it's with a real kind of social conscience. There's an entrepreneurial kind of feeling there, but there's also a little bit of serendipity. You seem to be in the right place at the right time. Is that fair to say? Is that an innate thing, do you think, in you? Is it kind of in the DNA, or is this something you've crafted over the years?
I wish I could say it was DNA, Neil. I think it's sheer luck. Social conscience, I'd like to think was there as a member of the local Friends of the Earth group. It didn't define my work in radio. But serendipity, I was there for the whole Madchester thing in the late 80s and doing a show about that on a weekly basis. That was huge fun. And the passion was very much there. But aligning that with social purpose, aligning your skills your skills and passion with purpose, that was a thing that really only came into fruition with social enterprise, with Radio Regen. And that was in part instigated by the bike ride. I never take my luck for granted in right time, right place. And I wish I could take more credit for it, but it's broadly been fluke.
I think you're being a little bit modest, and I'm sure anybody who kind of looks at your backstory will kind of agree that yes, there's something a little bit more thought through here than just purely purely luck. But anyway, we could debate that all day. But I think what I'm in really, obviously, really, really interested in is the current work and the, you know, the difference that you're making. And I love that positioning of the trust and the project within these kind of, you know, sort of two ends of the spectrum, which are, you know, quite polarizing, I guess. You know, you can go down the big formal sort of consultancy route, or you can go very much for the, you know, the pure activist route. And I think we know, you know, you've given two very interesting examples there who are probably at either ends of those spectra. And I think it's interesting that, you know, to sit in the middle there, where there is this kind of critical mass, I guess, of individuals who are potentially crying out for help, really, because they're either sort of feeling, I know I need to do something, and, you know, the words about, you know, protecting the children and things, it will clearly resonate. But also at the same time, there's this kind of complexity, or maybe perceived complexity, about the how to do it. You know, I've heard, you know, from so many different parties, it's like, we'll do that when we've got time. We're a bit too busy to worry about that right now. And it's frightening. I mean, are you seeing this actually as part of the project? Do you see either a resistance, or is there a almost a, well, it's not really happening, a denial kind of thing going on?
There's much less denial in that explicit way that we saw when we started. We're getting on for 10 years old now, and the goalposts have really shifted. If anyone is outright denying, it's either wrapped up with any number of well out there conspiracy theories, or with a sense of apology, you know, trying to mediate it within some bounds of, you know, your denial of established science, somehow mediated within the bounds of reasonableness. And there's some strange framing going on there. But the goalposts have really, really moved. And this is where we come in. We're seeking to establish a widespread shift in the way that we think and do stuff, so that action on climate is not other and is simply there. That's why we call it carbon literacy. Who would want to be illiterate, especially in the face of an existential crisis? Let me just define what I mean by existential crisis. It's not about the planet. It's about our ability to function as a civilization. The planet will ultimately be fine, even if we get into runaway climate, global heating. This is about our ability as a society, as civilizations, to function. I think the lessons we are learning through the pandemic, and now the appalling brutality inflicted on Ukraine, is how fragile our systems are. And now when I'm introducing the topic, I don't start with the science. I simply ask about the organization's experience of extreme weather and how it's disrupted them. And you start with that. I was talking to a group of stately home owners the other week, and that's exactly, I said, well, you know, how much have you had to close in the last 2 years due to extreme weather? Hands go up right around the table. There was no one who was unaffected. How much has this increased over the last, say, 5 years? Again, right around the table. No dissent. The recognition of the increasing incidence of extreme weather is there. And the blindingly obvious bit that this is going to mess us up was there. There's no pushback on that. Now, there's plenty of pushback on how we can resolve it. Whether there are more urgent things, I'm in no way diminishing the bandwidth factor, the mental bandwidth factor, that if you're faced with other, perhaps more imminent traumas, you automatically, well, obviously you react to those first. It's always been the issue with global heating, that it's still not in your face. I think it's something to do with Neanderthal psychology. You run away from a saber tooth in the cave mouth. And we're programmed to, you know, put up mental compartments around things we can't see, feel, smell. And there's still a sense that the climate crisis is in that bracket, but much less so.
It's very, I just find it fascinating the way that you've highlighted there that the science is showing, and I have to say I've read and heard quite a lot about this as well. The science is showing that, you know, the planet's fine, the planet will be fine, because these are just one of, you know, cycles that happen over various millennia, and it will bounce back, and it's us that's the problem, not the planet itself. And I think framing it that way suddenly brings a real responsibility and accountability back to the self. So it isn't something that you can look at there and say, oh, I'm feeling sorry for you, planet. No, this is, and I love the way that you couched it there. This is about society and individual and community response to the way that we are interacting with what we're doing and how we are acting as, you know, human beings and interacting with ourselves, not necessarily always, you know, to the best, you know, with the best kind of intentions in mind. And this is a really interesting take on things, because I think a lot of people are almost wrapped up in what they perceive to be the complexity of process. It's like, oh, well, it's too hard. We need to get a, you know, director of sustainable, you know, development, and we need to look at solar panels and recycling and all the kind of processy things. But you're saying actually it never began there, and it should have always begun with self and with human and the people interaction. This is a really interesting take. I knew this was going to be a good conversation.
It's almost a standing joke now. I have banned polar bears from carbon literacy training. I've got nothing against polar bears, honest. Gorgeous, amazing creatures. But the fact that they're bobbing around on melting ice floes of itself is insufficient to move us collectively in the shift of our behaviours to embrace a low carbon way of living. It's tragic and, and indicative, but it somehow has played, that classic imagery has played into this idea that it's about nature, in inverted commas, and still people haven't got, enough of us haven't got that thing that we are nature. And making that connection is vital. But starting with polar bears, I think, has actually diminished our ability to engage on this front. It is absolutely about us and nature, but it starts with us. We are selfish creatures, and we're best motivated by self-interest, however you define it, and defining that self-interest about care for others, care for the natural system and the way we interact with it is crucial. But that trigger into exploring that and acting on that has to be about self.
And it's really interesting, isn't it, when you see in the media reports this last weekend of the number of queues and cancellations on all the travel plans that people have had now because they're released back into, global sort of travel industry again. So they want to fly off on their holidays and this, that, and the other, almost with a complete and utter disregard for their own kind of personal impact on this process in this system. It baffles me. Honestly, I see this and think, what is it that people just aren't getting? And I think you've kind of summed it up there with this whole thing, is it's not close enough to them, is it, to really take effect?
There's a catch-22 that I consistently face in my job of getting people on board with carbon literacy. And it is people don't get carbon literacy until they're carbon literate. So getting people over that hump of sticking realization is vital to this. And even that is insufficient. It would be all too easy to get into the other version of denialism is doomism, paralyzing doomism. It's all too late, which is out there very much as well. So our work in this day's worth of training that we enact So our framework is about, yes, the penny drop moment, the oh crap moment, where you realize that, yeah, this is really flipping serious, and I can't avoid thinking about it, and I've got to do something about it. But then vitally getting into the doing. Without the doing, anyone in this engagement and comms and marketing piece, without engagement and agency, what can I do? What's the best thing I can do? And enabling that. If you're not doing that, that there'd be an argument for leaving people in blissful ignorance, actually, rather than dropping them into that trough of paralyzing pessimism.
And it brings despair, doesn't it? I think if people realize that it's like, it's just too, it's in the too hard to do box, there is this kind of despair. It's like, okay. And then it goes back to the denial piece that you were saying, which is like, oh, well, if there's nothing I can do, well, let me just try and deny it because then it might go away. And yet we know it's not going to go away. So it's kind of, okay, so what do I do? And I think if you're absolutely right, if they're starting from the wrong starting gate, they're going to be running a race that actually wasn't ever meaningful anyway. So I think this is a really, really interesting way that you and the project are kind of framing this, is that it is about just an understanding that even just to get a little piece of literacy on this whole kind of journey. So just taking that very, very first step allows you and enables you to understand what you didn't understand or what you didn't know. Because at this stage, you probably don't even know what you don't know, but just having the faith that this is actually now what we might term an essential skill or an essential piece of knowledge. They used to be called soft skills, didn't they? Presentation skills, and you know, people interaction used to be called soft skills. Well, I always call them essential skills now. And I think you've described this as being, this is one of those essential skills, you know, carbon literacy and your role in, you know, playing a part and being accountable for, even if it's just a tiny little proportion of what everybody else seems to be doing, that is the first kind of step on this journey. And then if you want to become an advocate or you want to become an activist, that's fine, that's in the future. But I think for everybody, I think what you're saying, if I'm reading this right, is that it is that just that first little step on the journey that we all are and should be committed to.
Going back to your picture of all our friends and family in those airport queues, it's too easy even to get critical of folk there, because I think part of carbon literacy is acknowledging your footprint in relation to others. Yes, any flight is a disproportionate contribution to a personal carbon footprint, but if your overall carbon footprint, and basically, if you're in a below average income, you're going to have a small carbon footprint, and that's your one splurge, as it were. Crack on, frankly, if you are looking at your carbon budget in a whole. So I think this is part of carbon literacy, is putting your own footprint in perspective and getting a handle on whether you are being excessive in your use of your allocation of your, I say, your ethical allocation of greenhouse gas use. And if you're splurging on one side, where else do you save? And depending on your own footprint and looking at what you can change, not beating yourself up, because this is another thing that can come in train with bad awareness raising on this. Is everyone's, I'm just going to have to eat, you know, really bad quality vegan burgers for the rest of my life in order to be a good person. You could see, and frankly, if you're struggling with your rent, dot dot dot, as so many people are, your footprint's going to be tiny. You should still do your bit in terms of raising the conversation, seeing what you can do with your community, with your employer, etc. So it's very much horses for courses. And this is another thing that carbon literacy brings in. It's not a one size fits all. And just knowing that one flight to the Mediterranean, it's not going to break the bank, hopefully. Bobbing off to New York for a shopping weekend, You know, and know it. So it's that scale of significance piece, which is part of carbon literacy, is really, really important. And aligning it with the rest of your well-being. There is a hierarchy of need, of course. And it has to fit into that. Alongside, I think then they shouldn't be mutually exclusive if, again, the person is given agency to do their bit.
There's a lovely practicality for me that's coming through here because, yeah, there is when you read a lot of stuff in the media, it is this big sort of like shaking stick pointed in your direction. And you think, oh, I'm a bad person because, you know, I'm doing this and I'm not doing that. And, you know, my electric car hasn't yet arrived. And, you know, I don't have solar panels on the roof. And it's almost like the name and shame game. And it's actually quite hard, isn't it? There's so much, I'm guessing, misinformation out there that doesn't give you the perspective that you're talking about. It feels like it's actually a lot easier to do. Is that fair to say?
It is. And I think part of the easy shift that we should focus on is a better life. Purpose Disruptors, brilliant organization within the advertising industry, who are, I think, just using their great creative skills to constructively subvert the damage that sector has done. They've got this beautiful mini documentary that basically asks, what are we doing this for? What makes us happy? And it comes to that conclusion, which is a bit of a duh type moment. It's connection. And connection with people around you is what so many of us actually strive for. And instead, we're being fed expensive stuff that doesn't make us happy. And if we can refocus onto social capital, to use the jargon, that sense of connection with people around us, a certain sense of self-validation, but what actually makes you happy? Hugs make you happy. Connection with people, being able to walk to the shops and, oh there's so-and-so, you're right. Just a little bit of letting on as you go on. That is priceless stuff. Compared to some of the planet trashing over consuming behaviors that we've been conditioned towards. And I think when you put that in front of people, there's no stretch. People know that instinctively. You know, you don't need a therapist's couch to get into this stuff, because I think people, you know, these are self-evident truths, surely.
Isn't it interesting, actually, again, the way you're describing this, that actually the better you are is by doing less. In fact, the less commitment you make to all of these things you're talking about and the less you consume, the better you're going to perform. There's a kind of a certain sort of irony there, isn't it? With most things, the more you put in, the more you get out. Here, the less you do, the more you get out. So it's a no-brainer, really.
I think not. Do might be misconstrued, Neil. You can do loads in terms of being active and engaged and experiencing stuff around you. My great win in the pandemic was dog walking, like so many, many, many people. And that daily walk, I've got a lovely common near us, just in the trees and just doing that every day, that's, again, really lucky to be able to do that. Fantastic, but priceless in terms of well-being. That's absolutely superb. And low carbon footprint, apart from the blooming dog food, but that's another issue.
Something always gets you in the end though, doesn't it?
Damn it, yeah.
So let's talk about the project then, because I have no doubt by this point, if people are thinking, actually, it doesn't sound as onerous as I thought. Neil, why didn't you get Phil on much earlier? Because if we'd known this before, I'm sure there would be people sort of thinking that. What are the steps? Because I've obviously sort of know a little bit about the project, but I'd like you to kind of explain it from your perspective, because it's kind of like a multi-level of engagement, isn't it? This literacy kind of journey. So I can come in as an individual and engage and see some stuff and do some stuff. But also, if I represent an organization, I might want to get a team of people together. There's kind of multiple ways that people can become more literate.
So we set out by saying we need to be carbon literate. We recognize that certainly 10 years ago, and still majorly now, climate solutions are being presented as something to be done to people. It's very much supply side. We'll do this bit of tech, we'll plug in this widget, we'll go renewable, etc. And this is the bit that does the other side of that, that answers the question, why should we? It's demand versus the supply thing that is still predominant. So how do you do that? How do you shift people's perspective and give the tools to them in a way that sticks and is accessible and scalable? So that was the challenge we faced with ourselves out of that first action plan in Manchester. And we gathered employers, campaigners, and academics, educators around the table and say, right, we've got this challenge, what do we do? And what we created was an adaptable framework for a day's worth of climate action training that any employer, any university, school or community can pick up and use. So we don't train. We enable others to use our framework, which sets out learning outcomes. Here's the carbon cycle. This is a greenhouse gas. This is the science. And by the way, this is how we know it's true. The IPCC, really, you've got to pay attention to the IPCC, etc. A bit about regulatory frameworks from the Climate Act, well, from COP, Climate Act, right the way down to your village or organization climate emergency declaration. All of that, some stuff in there about methodology. We insist on peer-to-peer delivery or maximizing peer-to-peer delivery, because if you have some middle-aged white guy with a gray beard, heaven forbid, land in your organization and preach at you, it's not going to be half as effective as one of your own. So peer-to-peer is one of the secret weapons. Collaborative inquiry is another thing. So it's not a passive lecture or flat screen experience. You engage with your colleagues, with your neighbors, in digging into this stuff. And relevance all the way through. Thus the banning of polar bears. Every course should start with a really strong statement from a recognized champion or leader in your sector, your field or your area, as to why this is happening. And it always ends with action. So every one of the now 35,000 certified carbon literate people have devised two actions, one for themselves within their own locus of control, and one which talks about what you will do with a group. You do all that. Now, within that framework, there are stacks and stacks of gaps in this day's worth of learning and doing. And you put your stuff in there, your local stuff, your sector stuff, your company stuff, your course stuff. So it's always got that flexible thing going on. And the other thing we bring to it is external validation. So we assist people in training design, but we certify the course and we step back and you, whoever you are, you train. And then we certify learners. So we bring that objective guide as to, you know, is this a carbon literacy course as we'd recognize it? Yep. Has this person passed? Yep. And that's what we do. That's our role, basically, in our dedicated team of evidence readers. Growing and growing and growing. But that's how we roll. I think we're in 17 nations now. Again, it's hard to keep up. I love the fact that there's a course in Spanish in Guatemala. Right. Our first course in Saudi has just been certified. I think it's yet to roll. And again, if this only worked in the UK, how pointless would that be in terms of the global challenge of the climate crisis? So, we're testing the limits of Google Translate, I tell you. But it's, this has to work everywhere. And so far, the theory of scalability is holding up.
So it feels like there needs to be somebody who will rise above the parapet and say, I'll be the sponsor of that in my organization. So they're listening to this. They think, okay, this is the way forward because I've been battling against the hierarchy. I've been trying to do little local initiatives. Yes, Neil, I did get it wrong. I did the system thing. I did the process thing. We've got a nice recycling bin in the corner of the office. And actually, Phil's just taught me that wasn't the way to go all along. But now I've heard this. I want to sponsor this. What would be the next steps naturally for, and let's just call them a sponsor, because I know a lot of people listening to this will be marketers, they'll be business owners, entrepreneurs. I know the audience for this. And so if they decide, right, I want to be a sponsor here, what would be their first steps? Because obviously they're going to have to, you know, build the momentum, aren't they, within the organization?
So much of our success is about framing. Again, homing in on the key existing priorities of the people that will make the decision. Again, part of what we do works is because we bring the climate crisis to where people already are. We don't ask them to adopt a strange set of values, you know, put on your cultural caftan. And, you know, it's about taking it to where people are. And I've got the extreme pleasure and privilege of doing this day in, day out. And also, I will assist anyone on the same mission. It's absolutely central to my job, strengthening the arm of any advocate. And sometimes it's a shop floor insurgency. Great conversations with folks saying, I've got no position here. How do I get this into the bloodstream of the organization? And sometimes it's the gaffer. Sometimes it's the boss. And right. You know, I just need to get this through the SMT, get the chair to sign off on this. So, you know, give me some collateral on this. And either way, it's propelled by stories. So, and part of, I suppose, it's the subconscious fun in this is, can you get this across the line without mentioning the word climate? In other words, what are the pressing other priorities that would enable an organization to invest resources in this training program? And I'm not being, you know, most organizations will have a pressing learning culture, and this has to find space. And whilst it's very, very cheap, we are consistently told, you still need to dedicate time for someone to design the training, deliver the training, and obviously the time of people experiencing the training. So getting that across the line is really important. So let's pretend for a moment that the decision makers that we're addressing don't care about a safe future for our children. Luckily, the vast majority of them do. But in terms of this exercise, let us pretend that they don't. Ask about supply chain pressures. Are any of your organization's clients already signed up to a science-based target? Will they imminently be asking you to not just measure but reduce your carbon footprint? Ask your finance director, do you know what a scope 3 emission is? And if they're scratching their heads, you know you've got a bit of a capability gap to be helped along with, as it were. In terms of recruiting, are you facing challenges in recruiting the young, bright and the best on this? How will your recruiting and retention be improved if you can step up as a purposeful employer on this agenda? In the employment market, are you facing pressures that mean that greenwash won't wash, that you have to walk the walk on this agenda? And carbon literacy training, the offer of carbon literacy training into the workforce, is a fantastic and achievable way of doing that. Also, we're told Jacobs Engineering have a fantastic behavior change, low carbon behavior change whiz, who's looked at what we do. And she tells us that you should expect a 5 to 15% energy saving in the average workplace if the training is supported appropriately afterwards. I think that's common sense. A motivated workforce is going to save resources. You know, it's just common sense. And I feel quite relaxed about that range, the 5 to 15% range there. So do you want to engage your team? Do you want to stop your environmental performance being simply the job of one hard-pressed environmental manager? Or does this go across the breadth of colleagues? And it's simply something that we do. And so those parallels I alluded to earlier about health and safety, about diversity, data protection even. It's just people don't think twice about this stuff now. And there's many, many an employer who certainly say to us, no, this is where we need to be with that. And that's without prompting. So it just needs to be up there. Auto Trader are our first FTSE 100. And you join the ranks of Auto Trader as a already invested heavily in being the best possible employer, but you join their ranks, and in your induction you get carbon literacy training alongside the rest of it, and that's where this is going.
Now that's a wonderful example. I think the Auto Trader example is, yeah, it surprises a lot of people when they dig deeply into it, just how good an employer Auto Trader actually is. And I think that's just a lovely little anecdote there. If you missed it and you were just listening through it, everybody, they include carbon literacy training in their induction program. Now, if you just stop and just think about that for a moment, that puts it at the core of everything that's the most important things within that organization. Because there's the evidence. You tell people in an induction all the most important things as they are the sponge in those initial days of employment. So if carbon literacy is right at the core for them, why couldn't it be? Why shouldn't it be for everybody else? So I was saying it's one of those essential skills that I think, you know, we're going to look back on these days or this year probably and say, you know, this was the year of shift. I mean, do you feel that, Phil? I just want to kind of sort of round up really by just getting your take on the future. You know, you have this lovely idea of this future for your children. We're kind of coming full circle, I guess, in the conversation. But are you optimistic about where this can all go?
It's a roller coaster, Neil. The more you immerse yourself in this climate stuff, there are extraordinary leaps forward at mind-boggling scale. Some of the stuff they're doing with energy storage and renewables in Australia, two activist billionaires pushing aside the might of the coal industry there with these extraordinary infrastructure projects. So the growth of carbon literacy, which is obviously all down to me, I wish. The phone keeps ringing, Neil, at Carbon Literacy HQ. You know, and this brilliant, brilliant array of organisations coming to us and signing up and going beyond their initial interest by being connected to people who are actually doing the thing. This is part of our strength. There's a critical mass of practitioners, hundreds of organizations happy to share their experience with interested organizations. So that really flies. So there's definitely a shift, but at the same time, you just see it and feel it. The science keeps coming back to tell us how crashingly urgent this is. When you have seasoned diplomats, and yeah, you know, diplomat as in someone who professionally is diplomatic, Antonio Gutierrez, when he talks about moving away from fossil fuel investment would be kneecapping us. What? That's not diplomatic language. So, in other words, you know, yes, lots of optimism, lots of sense of people waking up and seeking tools, much more the question of what can I do, not shall I do. But at the same time, the urgency is ever, ever more clear. The predictions from the IPCC are mediated. Yep, they've knocked off the more dramatic corners of the predictions. It's part of their job, and yet it's petrifying. Yep, you can't get away from that, and that in itself requires an emotional resilience that can actually only be provided through agency, through the feeling that you are actually doing your bit and contributing. So all the time we're in that zone, in our office, I'm surrounded by this amazing team, mainly of very gifted young people. And we go through these cycles, you know, a bad news story will ripple its way through the team, and we have to prop ourselves up and be emotionally resilient through that shared experience and, again, agency. So, yeah, optimistic. And then, of course, events. That you can't shy away from the fact that Mr. Putin has set us back with his psychopathic violence. You can't deny that the pandemic has not set us back through disrupting. Again, it's that bandwidth thing. You are faced with that imminent danger. The next most imminent danger is automatically deprioritized. So all these things are in play, and yet the demand for action, the appetite for action, the willingness to invest in action is increasing all the time. How it'll play out, I'm not a soothsayer. I know that there are loads of people going flat out to do their best on this.
So if we have hope, and to coin a phrase from a very well-known sports brand, we should just do it, I think is the essence here. There is no time to pause on this. There's no time to wait. There's no reason why you wouldn't do this. Get carbon literate. Simple as that. I'll advocate this. I know you're the director of advocacy, but my own little way, I'll advocate this story too. Where would people next?
Let's say that again. Where would people go next? It was exactly what I was going to jump in and say. Anyone can train. Yep. So if you like what we've been discussing and think it might be something that you could play a role in, have a look at carbonliteracy.com. There's a whole load of information in there. But in terms of who can train, anyone can train that sort of gets the climate thing, has a bit of knowledge and enthusiasm about it, and has some experience in training. Beyond that, you're good to go. We support training design. We support internal advocacy. There are modest price points. Again, all that information is on carbonliteracy.com. And get in touch. info@carbonliteracy.com is our bolting in tray. But get in touch. We're absolutely there to support. There is no zone in our lives to which this is inappropriate. You know, this is something which can be brought into, as I say, any workplace, any place of education, any community, any part of the world, and this can be done. And we've got this amazing body of best practice now that can communicate its impact into multiple areas of our lives. We've just so hit this critical mass now with what we're doing. It does speak for itself.
Carbonliteracy.com is the place that you need to go. Thank you so much for your time and inspiration and storytelling, Phil. I mean, I can now see and understand absolutely why you are Director of Advocacy. I mean, what is not to like about the storytelling, Phil Caudle? It's been really, really interesting, and for me, really, really interesting in the way that you framed this away from using the word climate. And the big challenge for everybody listening here is, can you talk this story without using the word climate? Because if you can, then you are probably ripe for being one of the trainers on this program. I think that almost qualifies you instantly if you can talk the story without using the word climate. So thank you so much for your time today, Phil. And and thank you on behalf of everybody listening as well for all the hard work that you're doing in this, you know, really, really worthy cause.
Thanks so much for the interest, Neil. And I look forward to talking to some of your listeners, I hope. We'll see. I'll let you know what springs from this conversation as well.
Please do. It'd be really, really good. Thank you so much.
Thank you.